interesting point of withdrawal. I think that exists in most people. But it has a basis, actually, that I think most people, even like the people who have got high positions in society, they get fed up with it and they escape somehow. So it has some fundamental feeling amongst people in society to withdraw from it in some way.
Yeah, I mean, if you're talking about as a form of escapism, then, you know, that's okay, everyone should do their own thing. But, I mean, if you're actually interested in changing society, which we are in the Socialist Party, then it's no good actually withdrawing from it because, as I said in the talk, what you're actually doing is withdrawing from the struggle that takes place. And, you know, ultimately, you can't escape the effects of capitalism. You can't escape the effects of nuclear war. It just isn't a realistic strategy. I mean, yeah, certainly people can go ahead and do that. That's what they think is useful, but really it's not. It's of no consequence to changing society.
Well, then in the case, say, now the socialist society, would it not be possible that a lot of people say, oh, this is too easy, let's get out of it?
I'd like to have a chance of saying it's too easy. Well, you know, I think humans have got lots of sort of potentialities that attracted in this type of society that we live in today, so we don't really get the chance to express ourselves as fully as we would like to. So no, I don't think that would be a problem in a future society at all. I think there'd be lots of things to do, isn't it?
Would
the
example of the Israeli kibbutz and how do you see that in terms of socialism or anarchism? Do you not think it's actually a fairly useful model to show people what society could possibly be?
Yeah, on the one hand, what it does is actually allows people to organise themselves and to develop relationships with other people in perhaps a more liberated manner. But ultimately, no. I mean, kibbutz ideas are influenced by socialist and I suppose some anarchic ideas. But you know, I mean, they're in the middle of a very oppressive society, and their existence depends upon a strong capitalist society. You know, Israel itself.
Yeah, and that's true. And within themselves, and within each kibbutz, and within the federation,
I've seen
that something that they come across problems, and they come to a border, and they have to deal with people outside their own system. Socialism is going to have problems, say, when it's just a country, it's going to have the same problem, and yet being able to deal inside the cell, it's still going to deal possibly anyway until the whole thing's end as well. So.
Yeah, or, you know, what the Socialist Party say is that you can't actually have a little piece of socialism. You can't have just a socialist community. It must be a worldwide system. What we're talking about is capitalism, which is a world system. And in order to replace that, you must replace that with a world system, which we call socialism. So there wouldn't be this problem of a socialist society existing on its own.
One of the problems you have in looking at the anarchists is that you have to look at groups beyond those that call themselves anarchists or libertarians who actually aspire to the same thing. For example, you mentioned the various communal efforts of the 1890s and early 1900s, which were out of existence. And yet, in most parts of the country, there are groups established, which might say anarchist lines, that have existed from 1880s up present time. One example is a self-supported group in Yorkshire, Brotherhood in Pontefract.
Yeah, I mean, I've
been there, and if you question them, they say, well, yes, we are for benefits, but that's not important. It's really the.
Yeah, I mean, you can actually go ahead and describe. I mean, really, anyone that describes themselves as an anarchist is an anarchist because it is your beliefs, your ideas, and there is no authority on anarchism. Yeah, no one's going to actually.
People would say they wouldn't regard themselves as anarchists at all, or libertarians, but they behave in the same way that anarchist communities. In other words, the non-propaganding anarchist groups.
Yeah.
And most of those who did a lot of land worked on the system of mutual aid. Mm. They weren't primarily concerned with propaganda, as, for example, the Freedom Press anarchists were. I mean, the Freedom Press anarchists during the 30s, 40s, and most of the 50s, they carried on in some ways very much like the Socialist Party. They had
regular meetings, produce literature, regular paper, debates and discussions and so on, on a regular basis, even at their own forward tip-up seats and so on. So that's just one group of anarchists, what you might describe as a surge of anarchists, and then the other types, often they didn't get on at all well. For example, Freedom Press had a large warehouse in Aldgate, and that they had the unhappy experience that the newly discovered student anarchists of the late 60s squatted in their premises. they had to decide whether they were going to throw them out. And apparently, they blocked the lavatories, and one of the printers on Express Print sort of called in the police and had them thrown out. With the result that the anarchists held a meeting and thoroughly disciplined him, and generally thought it was a terrible thing. And when the meeting broke up, they went round to the pub and patted him on the back, and then got rid of them. There's an example of, you see, so many differences in the anarchist
movement. Yeah. But what is interesting about your point, I think, is that that tactic of withdrawal does actually come as a sort of a despairing attitude. What you're saying is, you know, you can't actually handle society, you can't change it, so what should we do? Well, okay, let's withdraw. And this is what these anarchists did. You know, if you actually follow the sequence of events in Britain, for example, It does come after sort of these attempts to blow cows up and things like this. It's, you know, all attempts have failed, so what should we do? We'll sod the rest of you. What we'll do is go and live in our own community. But as a strategy for change, I mean, if you really are interested in changing society, it's nowhere. It's of no consequence.
Yeah?
Can I ask you about a brand of anarchists that you didn't really mention? These are the right-wing ones, the so-called anarcho-capitalists. Because they've got an interesting argument. What they stand for is a complete free market, the abolition of the state, and everything will run on a perfect market system. And what I've heard them argue is that, in fact, there's no real difference between themselves and the majority of people who call themselves left-wing anarchists. They're, of course, derided and scorned by the left-wing anarchists. But what they argue is that unless the left-wing anarchists actually advocate anarchy with the abolition of the wages system, then they're really no different from them, because if they advocate anarchy but don't want to abolish the wages system, what they actually want is a society without a state. As long as you've got the wages system, you've got a market. So basically you've got the same thing as the right-wing anarchists want, the abolition of the state but with a completely free market. And the fact that the left-wing anarchists very rarely refer to abolishing the wages system, if you read a paper like Freedom, very rarely will you get a reference to that. Very rarely indeed. They talk about doing away with the state and so on, and for which according to his ability and things like that, but they rarely explicitly say they want to do away with the market. And to that extent, isn't there a very great similarity, despite the difference in rhetoric, between the right-wing anarchists and the left-wing anarchists?
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, I suppose Margaret Thatcher's the biggest anarchist of the lot. But what we've actually... The party has debated against Libertarian Alliance, which is the group that you're referring to. This rejection of the state can actually seem to be associated with laissez-faire, this type of attitude. As regards to Freedom of Paper, as I said before, really, I mean, that to me, I think at one time it did describe itself as anarcho-communist, but that's gone. And if you actually read it, it's very difficult to find out where they do stand, because there are such a variety of opinions in that paper, and no one seems to be the clear line of the paper. So there's a variety, but yeah, I think you're right.
Any more questions?
On this point that was made about the kibbutz in Israel, there is in fact a fairly rigid hierarchy in these places. I mean, I think the way that children are treated in the kibbutzim in Israel is appalling. It's a very authoritarian sort of dormitory preparation for work, which is uniform and is controlled by particular people who are freeing the parents during the hours of the day when conventionally, in other parts of capitalism, parents are looking after their children to freeing the parents so the parents can carry on with labour of producing profits for the market, because that's what the kibbutzim were doing. I can recall the case of an Orthodox Jew who went to Israel to get a job on the kibbutz, and he went to one of these places, and the first thing that the person said to him, well, you're going to be in charge of the pig farming. he said, but I'm an Orthodox Jew, I don't touch pigs. And he said, never mind, I've been an Orthodox Jew, we can sell them.
They're not for eating, they're for selling.
There's nothing against that in the book. And, you know, this is it, all bows to the market. But, you know, I'm giving away my origins talking about this, but you mentioned the Arbeiter Frank, Yiddish paper that was published in Britain, and it was a very good paper. I don't know if anyone here sort of read it or read any copies of it. It was printed by the same people, incidentally, same family who now makes Sobrani cigarettes, and that's not really any consequence. They gave up producing the anarchist paper. They now make Sobrani cigarettes, and they. That newspaper, though, the interesting thing about it was that what they said, and this affected a lot of workers in the East End of London in the 1920s and the 1930s, was that you had the Labour Party and you had the Communist Party, and both of these were heavily statist parties. The Labour Party had shown itself to be a party that allowed all of the slums of the East End to develop. The Jews who came in as immigrants, a lot of Irish people who came in as immigrants, were living in these slums. And they were looking at the Labour Party and they said, this is not serving our interests. And they looked at the Communist Party, and despite the fact that the Communist Party has always had a certain amount of sort of what you might call Stalino-Zionists within it, who've managed to combine a love of two mythical promised lands, one in Russia and one in Israel, neither of which actually correspond. The qualification for holding these illusions is that you've never been to either, certainly lived in either. There's always been a certain amount of that. But the interesting thing is that a lot of them looked at the Communist Party, and a lot of the Jewish immigrant radicals in the 1920s and 30s rejected the Communist Party, and also as the 1930s went on, they began to see what was happening within Russia to a lot of the Jewish workers. And so what they said was, you've got to reject any kind of state at all. And really, a lot of what that movement was saying is something that you can see now on a much wider scale amongst workers in Britain. The average worker in Britain, if you go up to someone in the pub or at work and they say, what do you think of the Labour Party? The average person will say, look, the Labour Party has presided over and left me in the position that I'm in now. They've left us in a position where they built the council estates, they built the second-class welfare state, and they've left us with the crumbs living amongst them. They look at the Communist Party, they say this is a statist organisation. It's a mirror reflection of the Tory party at its most authoritarian. So a lot of people don't like parties, and I suspect there are people in this room who would look at the Socialist Party and look at what we say. We want a society without government, a society without money, a society without any wages system, a society where every person gives according to their ability and takes according to their needs, a society of free access to all goods and services. They would look at what we say, they would listen to the strategy that we have for getting it, that people have got to understand it, they've got to want it, they don't follow any leaders, everyone who joins the Socialist Party is equal. Membership of the party is only on the basis of one thing, and that is knowledge, and then there is no leadership within the party. Every meeting in the party is open. And then there are a lot of people who would say, but you've got the word party, socialist party, and they are afraid of it, and it's a healthy fear. Because, you know, they've been to parties, and it's like, you know, the debutante who's been to a party on Monday and a party, and by Friday night she doesn't want to go to any more parties. I don't blame her. And so that's why a lot of people are afraid. And how do you overcome that fear?
Well, Jim, just going back to Arbeiter Frank, I believe that was Rudolf Rocker's newspaper. He eventually took that over.
He gave out ham sandwiches outside the synagogue on the day of the fast. Called it a wedding grub. It's probably not.
I'll substantiate that.
Yep.
Or transubstantiate
it. The thing is, these Jewish anarchists had also existed in sort of the 1870s, 1880s, a much earlier tradition, I think, bringing traditions from their particular societies as well, from Russia and Poland and Germany. Also, it's interesting that where you actually find these people, what type of occupations they're doing, and they're in the clothing industry and bookbinding, this type of industry, cobblers. It's not really true. No, it's actually where workers have actually got time to sit down together and do a piece of fairly intricate work. I mean, watchmakers are the classic example. That's where Proudhon carried on a lot of his work with watchmakers. How do you actually get over this fear of the party? Was your question? Was it the idea of
fear of politics? Really?
A fear of politics. Well, really, I mean, I think the thing most people must recognise is that whether they're interested in politics or not, it's something that affects them. And what you've actually got to do is what say to yourself, how are you going to attempt to change society? If you actually believe that society needs changing, then how are you going to do that? And what alternatives are available to you? And to me, my opinion is that you actually go into an organisation that is attempting to do this. How else do you organise? How else do you get literature? How else do you meet people? I think it's a necessity that people should join a political organisation. How you actually overcome people's fears of political parties, I don't know, apart from encouraging them to come along to meetings, to actually take part in party activity and see how it operates. I mean, this is one way where you can actually throw open your doors. The party always has done, which had probably caused a lot of horror for a lot of left-wing parties, that all of our meetings and discussions are open to public inspection. And that is one method, but I mean, how you actually get everyone into 52 Clapham High Street, I don't know.
I enjoyed that talk very much. One thing I've never been particularly clear about with the anarchist writings I thought of is this idea of individualism. Because bearing in mind that we are social creatures and we acquire all of the things that we find useful, like language socially, it's a problem that seems to run through all of the various strains of anarchism you've outlined, that they seem to picture the social organisation that they advocate, based on various forms of individualism. Something that would puzzle me is how they substantiate that. I've never found any adequate argument to back it up. What does individualism amount to? An individual cast aside from society at the moment shortly after he or she was born would be less than, you know, moronic, would have no language and all of the other socially acquired and so on. So what does this individualism do?
Well, I think what you need to do really is distinguish between two types of individualism. There's the extreme egoism of Stirner, which is probably most anarchists would reject themselves. I mean, it just isn't practical. What anarchists do have, because they actually reject all forms of authority, they've got a very healthy regard for the individual, and that the individual should have the ability to make choices. And, you know, that ultimately that's what freedom's about, the ability of individuals to make their own choices and to be their own person. So, you know, I think that's a healthy element in the anarchist school of thought, that they do say that, you know, people should be responsible for themselves, without actually going over to the extreme of Max Stirner, where, you know, he really what it amounts to is a war against, you know, of each against all, and you couldn't possibly, well, I mean, there wouldn't be such a thing as society. How do you actually organise food production? I mean, I don't know. And people, I think, quite rightly have said that there are anticipations of Nietzsche in Stirner's writings, which, you know, it's survival of the fittest, the survival of the strongest. And that's the type of society those type of anarchists would, or position or condition that those anarchists would be advocating. But the vast majority, you know, would chuck Stirner out, quite rightly, I think. And they would have is, as members in the Socialist Party, a regard for the individual as well.
I think we're coming back briefly on that. What I think it takes, doesn't take sufficient note of, is that those individual choices that
we make, or we could make, are all socially determined in the sense that when we start to decide what it is that we want and how we're going to behave and what our lifestyle is going to be, those choices are something which are based on experiences which are social, and because of the very highly integrated network of society and the things that go along with that. This is aside from the arguments of how the most important aspects of how you produce food, clothing, shelter, and so on, but that can only be based on a highly organised, coherent, well-coordinated social production. But just aside from that, the other periphery matters to do with individual choice and behaviour, I think that there's an important gap in their understanding on that point.
Yes, yeah, some anarchists, but it is always difficult when you're talking about the anarchists, because you always have to, which anarchist you're talking about. But I think, from what I've read, a lot of anarchists would actually go along with what you're saying, that the individual is determined by his social environment. But they certainly don't have this conception of history, which that we have in the Socialist Party. That's where.
I just had a comment on this remark that Steve made about overcoming party phobia, and I think it's something we must address ourselves to very seriously. It depends on the image, surely, that people have of parties, and are they party? And we must present an image which is very attractive, and whether it corresponds to the sort of thing that people expect parties to consist of, it might not be so. It may be very different from what we normally see parties to consist of. And we should look and be quite open about the fact that we are going to change an image and make it attractive and find out what people want, what sort of organisation they would want to...
I totally agree with that as an organisation we are... we've been around for a long time, we've taken quite a few knocks, and it is important to change our image, but there is a lot of work that goes on within the party, which is dull and tedious, which must continue, and you can't really hide that from people that are wanting to join the party. A lot of the work is routine. A lot of it does consist of holding meetings and organising debates, this type of activity. And that is the lifeblood of a political party, I suppose. And I don't know how you could ever, apart from turn that into a circus...
Yes, there's always, back to the speaker's comment on Srimad, there's always seemed to me a connection between this sphere of political parties and why anarchists are against political parties. And that is because that most people associate it, quite rightly, with other organisations, that political party, organisation, equals hierarchies, equals authority. It seems to me it's the same... it can't be said that anarchists have got those ideas as well, that organisation equals authority. I wonder what you...
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of anarchists walk about with a lot of mistaken ideas in their head, and if you actually speak to anarchists, you find that what the Socialist Party are advocating, a lot of anarchists are in total agreement with, and they don't believe that a party exists in this particular format, that is democratic, without leaders, open to the public... They find this hard to accept, and they tend to look for sinister reasons that there must be some sort of someone wielding power behind the scenes in the Socialist Party. But all you can actually do is encourage these people to take part and to look at what goes on.
Yeah. It always seems to me that's undermining any of their ideas about individualism as well, because our organisation as such remains democratic, remains along those lines free, because We're conscious socialists. We're being individuals within it. Although we're actually in an organisation, we're being individuals within it. And it seems to me like a defect of the anarchists to come along and say, "I'm an individual." They actually think to actually join an organisation, somehow it's all going to be lost.
Yeah. Well, it's like a sort of a red flag to a bull, isn't it? Black flag to a bull. To actually mention the idea of a party, a lot of them just shun it and will have nothing to do with it without actually looking and saying this is a very different organisation from the Labour Party or the Social Democratic Party or whatever else.
An aspect
that you didn't touch on, though it was a very interesting and very comprehensive talk, so you can't touch on anything, but I think it's a view I have, I can't prove it, but that is the influence and interaction there has been on the British anarchists, or the anarchists in Britain, of their being side by side on so many occasions, whether it was in Hyde Park or in discussions of all kinds, over the last 80 years in Britain, as distinct from the anarchists elsewhere, where they didn't have that particular additional factor side by side. And I believe that the close familiarity of many anarchists, or the mainstream of anarchists over the years, that's to say freedom for most of the years, with the SPGB, was to their good as far as their ideas were concerned, but to harm them in their anarchist characteristics. In other words, I think the anarchism that one especially associates with Russia and Italy and so on, with the assassination and so on, has not been characteristic of Britain. Now that's partly, obviously, because Britain is a different kind of society and therefore it had its influence. But although that would be the obvious generalism, I think in fact there is the specific interaction that there has been over many years of anarchists and SPGB, and that is not just a notion on my part. It's interesting that each of the particular names, almost every one of the particular names that you mentioned representing different significant strands in anarchism in Britain in our times, you quoted from Nicholas Walter, Stuart Christie, Colin Warwood, each of those, from my own experience, and I'm sure it's from other people's experience here, has discussed extensively and is intimately aware of the SPGB position. I think that there is an interaction there. On the another oddity of the anarchists, I do think it's odd. I wouldn't want to make any particularly significant thoughts from it, but two other anarchists representing a particular trend, represents the same trend as Stuart Christie, but we're particularly familiar with Albert Meltzer, because we had two debates with him in this very branch. But he is a key figure in the Black Flag group of anarchists who broke away from freedom and seemed to extol the more continental tradition of bomb throwing and violence and so on. Yet, oddly enough, as those of us who know him can confirm, in his own personality, he is the mildest and kindest of people, very much out of character. I think he perhaps is there to balance up Stuart Christie, who not only believes in those ideas, but from my own experience, practices them. That's one thing. And the other thing, the other of these trends you mentioned, I, like you, haven't been able to understand what their real case is. But that's not because he isn't familiar with us or we're not familiar with him. The main representative that I've encountered over a number of years of the Max Stirner view is a very kindly person who is quite well disposed to the SB and is to be seen at our meetings indoor and outdoor from time to time, Jack Parker. He publishes a magazine which is very characteristically named Minority of One, and that is about the size of his organisation and the size he'd want it to be, I suppose. But I haven't been able to really understand what sort of proposals they have to propose, but it's very odd that for such a self-centred concept, he is a particularly unselfish-seeming and unegotistical-seeming sort of bloke. Just as a matter of interest. Another detail, and I hope you'll excuse the anecdotes, but I think it has some interest. Rudolf Rocker was mentioned, and by the way, my evidence for that story that he and other comrades of his stood outside a synagogue on the Day of Atonement offering ham sandwiches is his own biography of those years, and I recommend it. It's a very good read called My London Years. And an interesting thing is that it was written in Yiddish, a language which he spoke and edited this paper called Arbeiter Freund. But more remarkable is the fact that he wasn't Jewish. Yeah. And a number of non-Jews who not only mastered that particular language but edited a paper in it and wrote poetry and literature in it is pretty few, far between, I would think. The interesting thing about that paper is that although it was funded by the people who later on went on to make Sobrani cigarettes, it was typeset by the father of the man who typesets, or has typeset and certainly designed, our very own Socialist Standard in its format since mid-60s. In other words, Lionel Selwyn, who redesigned it after a very dreary patch of a number of years and made it the very attractive typographically publication that it is. He is a printer, but his father was the typesetter of this particular magazine, Arbeit der Freund.
Yeah, just a couple of points on that. Yeah, you may be right about this interaction between the party. I don't know if that could with the anarchists and the SPGB, because sometimes it is forgotten that what we are talking about is very small minorities of people that do intimately know each other and do take the same journal. So when you look at, say, figures for who reads Freedom and then who reads Black Flag, this type of thing, it is quite often it's the same people buying the same journals and, you know, mixing with the same people and attending the same meetings. So, yeah, you know, that I don't know, but that could be the case. Plus another thing is that the SPGB has tended to be an organisation centred in London, and most anarchist activity has tended to be centred in London. Glasgow's the other area where it has sort of had some influence, but yeah, you're still talking about very small numbers. Black Flag, Meltzer's paper, is that the organ of the Black Cross? That was set up after Stuart Christie had been to Spain, and it was to help political prisoners or anarchists in prison. I think it was designed for that purpose. With regard to the social psychology of various anarchists as well, Max Stirner himself was, I think, called Caspar Schmidt, and he was apparently a timid schoolteacher. I mean, there is always this sort of disjunction between these violent sort of statements that are made, and then you actually meet sort of a little quiet, bald-headed, bespectacled person, sort of this violent anarchist. Lambrosio, someone who did a lot of work on criminality, he actually went and studied anarchists as well, and, you know, he said that they were a particular type of person, they had particular physical features as well. I think there is a bit of a myth about this gentle anarchist as well. Kropotkin's often described as a gentle anarchist, and from what I've read, he sort of went to demonstrations with daggers in his back pocket and this type of thing, and he'd escaped from prison a couple of times, I think, and he wasn't as gentle as he made out, and he also supported World War I, which was